Thank you very much, everyone, for the day so far. And thanks to Oxbis and Rodeamos el Diálogo for the invitation to be here. Andre invited me to come and talk for 15 minutes about peace education, which is a very daunting task, even when it came through in the email. And then I got the program and saw that Jean-Paul Lederach would be introducing the day. And he wrote a book, Educar para la Paz, in 1984, which raises a number of the tensions that I'm going to discuss today. And I think that's an interesting point, that we're, you know, still discussing many things that have been in the literature since Jean-Paul wrote that book, since Paulo Freire wrote before him, since Antonio Gramsci wrote before him. So many of the tensions that I'm going to raise in this presentation are things that those of you interested in education, and many, all of us who've been through some form of education, have probably encountered and thought about. So that's an interesting reflection for us, I guess, around the ways in which we're still talking about and not moving past some of these tensions. So thinking about how to fill this 15 minutes and this daunting task, I thought I would really reflect upon this question about who builds peace, and these and the prompting that the conference has asked us to do around relationships at international, national, regional, and local levels. So starting with the international, there's a really strong conviction, and this is just epitomized by the quote that we see here from former Secretary General Kofi Annan, that education has a crucial role to play in building peace. There's an assumption and a conviction and a certainty, in fact, that education does build peace. And we hear this time and time again, despite the fact that there's not necessarily convincing evidence of that this is the case, particularly looking at formal education. And we mentioned the Ukraine situation earlier, and there's enormously high levels of education in both Russia and Ukraine, formal education. So this conviction that going through some form of formal education will necessarily be peace building is one that we need to be critical of, I think. Nonetheless, there's been huge effort, particularly this century, to generate resources for and build evidence around this conviction. And we've talked a lot about peace building actors at the conference so far. There's also been a lot of work in education from development and humanitarian actors. So I'll try to briefly outline the contours of this conviction at international level. So in the international development sector, education has long been seen as central from both economic understandings of development, in that education builds human capital, and from human rights understandings of development, in that education is an enabling right that helps us to then access other rights via becoming educated people. And conflict within international development understandings is understood as development in reverse, to borrow a World Bank term, and therefore its restoration is seen as an important peace dividend in the reconstruction after conflict, again, to use World Bank language. Since the turn of the century, the protracted nature of conflict and ensuing displacement has required humanitarian actors also to expand their remits into education. So education is now considered a fourth pillar of humanitarian response, alongside food and water, health and shelter. And this means that humanitarian actors are now involved in providing education, as well as providing other forms of humanitarian assistance. So we see that education is squarely a part of international response to conflict by both development and humanitarian actors. Development actors have concentrated on expanding access to education and improving its quality, including within the Sustainable Development Goals agenda, where Target 4.7 explicitly includes the provision of education to build a culture of peace and nonviolence, which is a first for these education and goal-related agendas to explicitly include peace education within the goal targets. Humanitarian actors, like I said, have become education providers, delivering education in refugee and displacement situations, and also increasingly developing strategies for longer-term responses, including the integration of displaced learners into national systems. Now, critics, including those concerned with peace and peace education, I'm looking at Hillary, who sat here, and her colleagues are here, another daunting part of my responsibility given the expertise in the room. But critics concerned with peace education have argued that these development approaches have promoted and expanded a universalized approach to education that's more concerned with getting children's bums on the seats and instrumental learning outcomes than with relevant and culturally sustained forms of learning. And the introduction of humanitarian actors into the education field adds additional challenges because they've raised the challenges for them of introducing education work and working with what they describe as a political thing, which education, of course, inevitably is. But humanitarian actors find that working in education compromises their neutrality, and therefore they can't discuss things like how historical narratives are taught. In fact, it's easier to not teach history whatsoever in order to maintain this concern with humanitarian neutrality. So in general, there's questions around these ideas of neutrality and detachment from politics and humanitarian work, but then trying to maintain that sort of false, arguably, commitment to neutrality and depoliticization in the education sector raises additional challenges, especially for peace education. And this means, sorry, now I've gone off my notes. Where are we? So taken together, we've got this universalist approach to what education is and what it looks like and how it's delivered and what the important things that learners should take from it are, plus a commitment in some cases to neutrality in its delivery. And this means that discussions of peace beyond the most generalized understandings are often impossible in education situations, in international approaches to teaching about peace and conflict. This is evident, this kind of very toned down and neutral and content-free almost understanding of peace is evident in lots of the internationally produced materials, and I've got a couple of examples up here. So we see peace education, when included in these kind of interventions, which it often isn't, but when included, it tends to focus on human rights knowledge, on attitudinal change, on individual level skills, and it's very conceptualized in terms of the locus of change on the individual learner as a detached, autonomous person whose attitudes will generate peace if those attitudes can be shaped in this universalized understanding of human rights education. So we really see the individual learner and their psychology as the locus of change and the place where peace is built, without an attention to conflict analysis, to contextual specificity, or to structural change. So that's a brief picture of this kind of level of international commitment, which is very strong and striking, but has these tensions, which, as I mentioned, have been highlighted for a long time. When we move beyond commitments and convictions and goals at the international level, however, it becomes clear how implicated education is with conflict and violence, and therefore how important attention to conflict analysis, structural change, and contextual dynamics are to the processes and prospects of meaningful peace education. So on this slide, we've got a smaller photo of a group of Palestinian students and their teacher. And they're holding their lesson, not in their school, but at a checkpoint, because they were denied the possibility to pass the checkpoint on that particular day and get to their school. The other photo is from a beautiful series by Colombian photographer Juan Manuel Echevarria called Silencios, and it's one of a series of photographs of schools, empty schools, in communities displaced by armed conflict. And there's a whole series, and they're stunning photos. So both of these examples, I think, are really evocative demonstrations of the ways that children and young people learn about conflict and peace, not from those universalized descriptions of what human rights are, but from their own encounters and lived experience with conflict and peace, and the ways in which violence enter their schools and their classrooms and their daily lived experience. So through very direct forms of violence, like we see in these slides, and also through normalized forms of structural and cultural violence that can shape the kinds of schools that they're able to access, who they do and do not encounter in their classrooms. It was really striking when we heard from Brandon earlier that it's still 93% of children, I think it was 93, was it? Yeah, thanks. Students in Northern Ireland who are still learning in segregated schools according to their faith groups. So this chance or not chance to encounter others in school is really important, I think. And the kinds of knowledge and histories that are included and excluded from their curricula at school. So just highlighting the ways in which schooling transmits both direct and indirect or structural cultural forms of violence that young people learn about and encounter and either have tools or don't have tools to make sense of, thanks at least in part to whether or not there's some form of peace education that can offer those tools. So a pre-cooked, to borrow a term from friend and anthropologist Jason Hart, who's done a lot of work with Palestinian young people and who is the person who's given me this photo. He says a pre-cooked approach to peace education curriculum is really unlikely to help children make sense of these experiences or to provide them with a sense of their potential roles in explaining them. And as Rula, a Palestinian girl who spoke to Jason about her experiences crossing checkpoints to get to school, said, they talk about child rights, but they don't see our situation. So this leaves a critically oriented researcher interested in peace education pointing to these tensions and challenges that have been pointed to for decades within a system. And I think this has been an interesting theme throughout today as well, our roles within a system that we're connected to and also complicit with. We've talked a lot about connections and relations and webs, but less about complicity within networks of geopolitics like Andre was pointing us to. So I think there's interesting reflections for those of us who inhabit more international roles, maybe particularly there. But the critical researcher is left pointing to tensions as Paulo Freire did, as we already mentioned, decades ago, and calling for the kind of radical transformations of education systems that we've not regularly witnessed. So I wonder sometimes, for example, if in Colombia, there were an attention to structural change, structural reform of an education system that has huge inequalities between urban and rural in terms of the outcomes of education and the opportunities that are delivered, and really great socioeconomic segregation in terms of private and public schooling. What if that kind of transformation were one of the institutions of a peace process? But these kind of radical transformations of whole education systems are not common. So calling for those also offers a frustrated suggestion to the teacher who's trying to deliver and make a difference and really committed to delivering peace education to their students. So, and to practitioners who are committed to the potential of education to build peace, which is certainly a real potential despite the challenges and tensions that we've raised. So I've had this amazing opportunity recently to try to move beyond that paralysis of pointing out a lot of problems, calling for radical change that is needed but hard to see happening, to try to do something that I think echoes with some of what Jonathan was saying around transferring resources and supporting educators who are starting from a point of analysis of those tensions and then trying to offer something that develops peace education in creative ways. So this is a project with colleagues, initially started with colleagues in Colombia, Cambodia, Pakistan, and Uganda, and now expanded to 18 countries, that takes these tensions in peace education as a starting point, transfers resources, in this case, from the United Kingdom Research Institute's Global Challenges Research Fund to educators and activists who are delivering peace education approaches that start from this seeing the situation of their learners that Rula was talking about before, the student that I quoted from Palestine. So seeing the situation and then trying to develop some kind of approach to peace education. And the project is called the Education Justice and Memory Network. We have the privilege of having £2 million to work with on this project over 4 years, which again is not a long enough time frame, but in research funding world is also longer than we often have. And it includes working with colleagues here in the UK, which I think is really important to say and was a real challenge for our funders who want 1 minute. That's perfect. I can do it. Who want this money to be transferred to places that have problems with conflict, which is not the United Kingdom in their opinion. But we've managed to push back against that and work with colleagues in the UK who are addressing the complete absence of peace education in our education system here, despite many divisions and inequalities and injustices. So we are working to develop creative approaches to peace education, as I said, and they include a clear focus on understanding past violence and injustice experienced by learners and their forebears, and exploring those legacies in the present. And because I have 1 minute, let me just really quickly highlight three things. We're just beginning to try to think about how we synthesize this work. But one important thing to say is that most, not all, but many of the projects are not working formally in schools. Some of them are conceptualizing their work as directly about repairing the damage that formal schools have done to the young people that they're working with. They interestingly, while they don't reject the label of peace education entirely, peace is not one of the most frequent words that they use when describing their methodologies and goals. So they talk about healing, repairing, redressing, decolonizing, unraveling, remembering, storytelling, co-creating, et cetera, and these are perhaps steps towards peace, or perhaps priorities that are the most important at this moment for this work. And finally, in the same way that universalized approaches fail to see the situations of violence, direct and indirect, that shape learners' understandings of peace and conflict, they also fail to see the daily encounters with peace and the ways that young people are building peace in their daily interactions, in their relationships, their feelings, and their dreams. And so these projects are working to sustain those daily peace interactions, to amplify them, and to learn from them. So that's it.